Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all come out after having a party last night. I realize it's not the 9 a.m. session, so I really, really appreciate that. Hopefully everybody had fun. My name's Jennifer Gagnon. I'm a senior program manager with the Office 365 customer experience team focusing on adoption. I've been with the company for probably about 11 years, working as part, started with an acquisition of FrontBridge. Some of you may have heard of it. So I've been with the service for roughly 11 years, almost 12 years now, I guess. Yeah. It's been a long time. These days, I actually focus on archive e-discovery, but it doesn't mean I haven't forgotten about Exchange Online Protection, so that's partly why I'm here today. I am joined by Wendy Wilkes.
I am also a program manager on the CXP customer team, and EOP is kind of my bailiwick, and we are here to take you guys through what entails a successful setup for EOP.
So before we get started, oh, there's one here. There's two microphones I think we've been able to identify in the room.
Back there.
If you have any questions, please come up to the microphone. It'll just make it a whole lot easier for everybody in the room to hear what you have to say and for us to answer your questions. We also have a lovely thumb drive with Tony Redmond's book on it, which is a $45 free of charge. So the first 10 people that ask us questions and come up to see us.
After.
At the microphones, of course, asking the questions at the microphone. Come see us afterwards and we'll give you one of the thumb drives. So I'm actually going to turn it over to Wendy to get us started.
So how many people in here have already deployed EOP? Quite a few. So one of the things that you hear in an EOP discussion is, you know, how you do everything, and then at the end you get the architecture slide. I personally think the architecture slide in the beginning makes it easier to understand why you're getting the instruction in the order that you're getting. So I just want to talk through a little bit of what the mail flow is when the messages are being filtered by Exchange Online Protection. And this mail flow doesn't change whether you have mailboxes on premises or if they're in Exchange Online. When your MX record is pointed to the service for delivery, there's a whole bunch of perimeter protection that we have in place before the messages actually enter our network. We do IP reputation, we do an SPF check, we can check the DKIM signatures on the messages. We have reputation-based blocking that happens right at the network perimeter. If the message is allowed through that layer of filtering, then we go through to the anti-malware layer, where we've got multiple anti-malware engines that will evaluate the attachments on the messages to determine whether they are known bad messages. We have constant signature updates throughout the day, so that as soon as we can get the information to start protecting your email, we put that in place. After the anti-malware scanning layer, then we do what's called policy enforcement, and this is where you have the opportunity to impact your own message flow. Through the exchange transport rules that are available inside of EOP, you can safe list specific senders, content, attachments, block them as well. I mean, there's an entire full suite of options that you have there for being able to control the destiny of the messages that you want to get through. If the messages are not blocked by you at that point, then they go through our anti-spam layer. Inside of our anti-spam layer, we've got the enforcement of safe and blocked senders. If you have synced that information into the service, we have content scanning with heuristics. We have spam analysts who actually update rules based on feedback that we get from you, and that will allow those messages to be identified as spam there. If we have about 12 or 13 different additional spam filtering rules that you can put in place on those messages, one of those is that, like an SPF hard fail, if you wanna just make sure that the SPF record is correct and they have a hard fail option, you can mark those messages as spam, and then they will be treated according to the settings on your spam policy. After this point, if you have ATP included, then we do the ATP processing, where the safe links and safe attachments are evaluated on those messages, and then we deliver through to the Exchange Online network, or we deliver through the connectors to your on-premises system. We get the feedback from your users on whether or not we've incorrectly or correctly identified something as spam, and then we can update our rules on our side through our spam analyst action. For outbound mail filtering, we still do anti-malware filtering as the messages egress the system. There is the ability to do policy or so transport rules on your own outbound messages as well. When we evaluate the messages, we still do spam scoring. If we determine that the mail is good, then we'll send it out through our regular outbound pool of IPs. If you have configured a custom connector for delivery either to your on-premises system or to a partner system, then we'll honor that instead of do the MX lookup to deliver to the messages. And if we've decided that the message is a little sketchy and may be considered spam, then we will deliver it out through our higher risk pool of IP addresses.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the deployment scenarios. So when you're using Exchange Online Protection, you can do it standalone with your on-premises mail servers and having all your mail on site. You can do it in hybrid, so you have some of your mail on-premises and some of your mail in the cloud, or you can simply give us all of your mailboxes and we can host them for you in Exchange Online. The nice thing about the standalone is really all you need to do is change your MX record and you're done. I know, sounds super easy. There's a little few more steps to that we'll get into. One of the things that we should note is PowerShell is a little bit different depending on what your configuration is. There is a different entry point for standalone versus Exchange Online. So essentially, I did say you just change your MX record and you're done. There are six steps if you want to sort of kind of take it to the high level. First of all, you want to take a look at what your prerequisites are. We'll go over that in a second. You want to configure your mail flow. That usually means your connectors. Add and validate your domains to make sure that we've got the correct information to route your mail. As necessary, you want to customize any spam and policy settings. Depending on the system that you're coming from, you may need some of the stuff that you had before. Quite frequently, you may not need the stuff that you had before. And we'll talk about that a little bit. Enable your mail flow, which is changing your MX record, and then watch it and fine tune as it goes along. So from a prerequisite scenario, this applies to everything. You need an Office 365 tenant, you need your subscription, and you need your domain to migrate. When you're looking at standalone or hybrid scenarios, you want to also be mindful of the inbound and outbound public IP addresses. You want to open your port to port 25 so that you're accepting mail strictly from us, and in the deck, once you get it, there is a link to that TechNet article available for you. You want to take a look and see if you've got any TLS policies within your organization, if you might need to set that up. Take a look at what your attachment handling is, what your policy is for handling that junk mail once we've identified it. And then also take a look and see if maybe you might need DirSync. And again, we'll talk a little bit about that. If you do need DirSync, you might need some additional hardware. So when it comes to configuring mail flow, from a standalone perspective, you want to make sure that you create your EOP outbound connector to deliver your mail on premises. It's a little bit confusing. We kind of take a look at it from our standpoint out to you versus into you in that regard. You want to create an inbound connector into accept mail, and then also, depending, you want to create an on-premises send connector going mail out through us if you choose that. If you're going to go hybrid, we definitely recommend that you use the hybrid configuration wizard as they make updates and things. It'll make sure that you stay in a configured or supported configurable state. And then as I talked about earlier, again, if you need TLS, you want to take a look and see what those policies are and create your connectors accordingly in that sense. When we're talking about doing your connectors and your configuration, there is, again, as we talked about for standalone, there is that inbound and outbound connector between on-premises and EOP. Those do need to be created manually. If you have a partner environment, you also maybe want to move to the next part. There we go. You want to also make sure that you get that outbound partner connector set up. Again, some partners require that TLS connection, so when you're setting up that connector, it would be at that point that you would talk about the TLS in that sense. You can create additional TLS connectors as needed.
So there's another way that you can use connectors that we call criteria-based routing. So if you have certain mail flow requirements that are not supported through a single connector scenario. For example, you need to be able to route mail to Europe for one group of people, or Asia for another group of people, and North America for a third group of people. You can set that routing up inside of EOP so that you don't have to worry about the mail having to bounce around within your on-premises system. And the way we accomplish that is through transport rules. And so you'll create a connector that is used with transport rules, and then you'll just set up a transport rule for the criteria you want to match on. If you create a group for the people, or you create a base the rule on an attribute of the people, however you want to set that up. But then the mail for those guys will go through their criteria-based routing connector, and then you don't have to bounce the messages around inside of your organization.
So we decided that we didn't want to be at the mercy of the demo gods this week, and so I created a little video that walks us through the connector wizard. So let's see if I can actually get this to work. So when you go in, you want to take a look at your mail flow, click on the mail flow, click on connectors, simply a matter of adding it. You want to select where your connector is going from, and then where your mail is going to, and it will identify for you if that is the right connector based on the scenario. Once you do click next, you want to hit enter in your information for your name, maybe perhaps a description, decide what happens with that connector. You also want to make sure that you add your smart host as well, just to make sure that for that routing it goes the right place. Go ahead, click next. This is where you would identify, if make sure that all of your settings are correctly identified, that you've got your TLS set up as needed, and then you would just go ahead and simply click validate.
So one of the things about the connector validation is you need to make sure that the address that you put in here is one that would be expected to go through that new connector. Because if you put an address in that wouldn't go through that connector, then the validation will fail, because not that the message wasn't deliverable, but that it didn't actually go through that connector.
Good point.
So when you are routing between your on-premises and Exchange Online environments, we recommend strongly that you don't put anything in between those machines. The not hybrid server that you have on your on-premises needs to talk directly to Exchange Online. When you're configuring the connectors, we set them up so that you preserve your headers, and that's how Exchange Online knows that the messages have already come from your environment or been through EOP and routed through your environment and come back if you've got centralized transport configured. But it's really tricky to get that information through if you have any non-Exchange system in the middle, because the header firewall will strip out any headers that they don't understand. So when the message comes back into the service, we don't have what we need to be able to identify that it's already been through if it's already come through. There's Mike right there. Hello? Okay, go ahead. Say your question. I'll repeat it back. Correct.
So it would be a different process. But what is the difference between that scenario and scenario where you have a partner organization and you cannot control what partner organization you have? What is the difference in between the two scenarios?
Okay.
How can be that EOP cannot handle internal mail flow through something in between and can handle the same situation with partner organization?
So the question is, if EOP has to have this exchange-to-exchange conversation in order to identify internal mail, then how is it able to handle email from partners without having that header preservation? And you stated that partner mail being treated as internal, but it actually isn't. Right, so if the mail comes through a partner connector, there are no internal headers there. So that mail will deliver, but it will not be treated as internal. And the thing you get with internal is you get a directory resolution, you have the ability to share free busy, you get to not double spam scan your messages. messages coming from a partner organization are not from your own domains, so they're not as hard for us to just process through, because they're not normally expected to route through more than one time. But the internal headers are not required for partners, and they're not even, that's not an available option on the partner connectors. One of the other things is, and kind
of. There's a couple people going to the mic
more,
in the middle.
Oh, cool, more questions, hi.
We're in a hybrid situation now, and our MX record is on-premise. We're looking at moving it to EOP. Do we have to reconfigure the hybrid configuration wizard again to recreate those transport rules and mail flows?
So it was a little hard for me to hear, but I think you said you have already run the hybrid configuration wizard. You're now looking to move your mail to EOP, and do you have to run the hybrid configuration wizard again?
Correct. We still have on-prem mailboxes, but most of our mail is in Exchange Online. Do we need to reconfigure and rerun the hybrid configuration wizard because it changed anything?
If nothing has changed, then you should have the same setup, you know, from, you shouldn't have to run it again.
All right, so it's just a matter of changing the MX record then?
Switch the MX record. Double check just to make sure that no certificates have changed or anything, you know, since the first time you ran. I don't know how long it's been. It could have been years at this point since the hybrid config wizard was run the first time. But just make sure that the connectors that it put in place still look like they should match.
So and the only connectors we have that we think that we need to rerun would be the TLS connectors, because our inbound and outbound routes will be changing. And in that case, it's just a matter of making sure that our inbound and outbound is coming from Office 365 instead of on our on-prem.
So I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
So we have TLS connectors that currently go from our on-prem directly out.
Yep.
Those need to be changed and pointed so that they go from Office 365 instead. So those connectors and
correct.
So those connections between our partner and us need to be redone when we move our MX record.
Yes, the send connectors that you have currently configured delivering to the internet, those need to be configured to relay to Office 365. I highly recommend using certificate to identify those connectors. If the hybrid config wizard hasn't done that for you already, just double check that. The certificate authentication for the handoff into EOP is pretty important. For current partner connectors that you have configured on premises, the hybrid config wizard would not set those up for you inside
no,
of EOP.
So, we set them up.
Yeah, so set those up. And then also we've had a requirement from partners that they understand which IPs they should be expecting mail from. And so the same list of outbound IPs that are available to you as the subscriber of EOP is the same list of IPs that we use for partner connector communication. So regular outbound mail could come from different IP addresses, but the IPs that are used by the connectors use the IPs that we have posted for EOP mail flow.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
Hi, I have kind of a two-part question. So we have a split namespace. We're higher ed, so basically we have our students in Office 365 and we have our faculty and staff on-prem. We use a third-party DLP solution. And I guess I want a clarification. So what I'm understanding here is can we put that DLP in between our Exchange servers and the Exchange Online protection?
So it depends.
Okay.
That's like a standard Exchange response, right? It depends. Do you require DLP between your hosted mailboxes and your online mailboxes, or is DLP for external mail?
It's just for external sends from our on-prem mailboxes.
Right. So then what I would recommend is two different connectors from EOP. You have one connector that's for the hybrid mail that talks directly to Exchange.
Okay.
And then your mail from the on-premises mailbox that goes to your online mailboxes would use that same connector.
Okay.
And then a different connector that would point to your DLP for external.
Okay.
And that way, you don't have to worry about whether you're going to lose the headers, you're not going to lose your internal treatment of the messages, but you're still going to be able to achieve the DLP action through your existing solution. The other thing I would say is if you take a look at the requirements that you're using your DLP, if we have those DLP options available inside of Exchange Online,
yeah,
it really is easier to have everything all in one message pipeline.
Okay. And that's what I figured. I just wanted clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My question is, it's kind of similar to his. I noticed in point one it says that, you know, EOP must, you must not pass through a third-party gateway. Our situation is we currently route mail through, as it's coming externally to internal, we're on-prem. It first hits two third-party gateways that do, you know, filtering and malware stuff, and then come in. Is there any problem with having it route from, as it is now, come through the third-party gateways, do the scanning and investigation there, and then pass into EOP, and then to on-prem?
So you can do that. If you're going to do that, though, I recommend that you go through the effort to disable all of the spam filtering inside of EOP. When you have that spam filtering taking place outside of EOP and then spam filtering again inside of EOP, you run into problems where if you've got, if the other solution is sending spam through, that could be identified as a submitter of spam. As the second point here talks about, we lose a lot of our reputation logic, so our spam filtering is less effective if we can't check the SPF record of the original sender. We can't do the DKIM comparison. We can't use our IP reputation list. And so if you're going to have that provided by somebody else, then we recommend you turn it off inside of EOP, and that reduces confusion for your end users, where something is marked as spam, and then they're reporting it to us, and we saw that it was passed through the service completely, and we didn't spam scan it at all. Okay. That feedback is not getting back to the people who are actually misidentifying the messages.
So follow-up question. So you're saying that if I do it like that, then EOP sees my third-party gateway as
the originator of every single message that comes through.
Okay, that's where I was going. Thank you.
Sounds like a good point.
Okay, so this is this inbound attribution. If you've been playing with the service very long, you've probably heard attribution. This is one of the reasons why I recommended the certificate on your outbound connectors. When a message comes into EOP for delivery, we will accept it under a few very narrow conditions. If the sending domain is one of our customers, if the connecting connector. If the connecting conversation is coming from a connector that is configured as one of our customers, or if the recipient domain is one of our customers' domains. And so it's important that you make sure that if you want to relay your mail outbound through EOP, that you're using that certificate in order so that we can identify explicitly that that's coming from your organization. You can also use IPs if you need to. It's less precise, and we prefer certificates. One of the challenges we have is multiple people using the same set of IPs, and that will result in what's called safe tenant attribution. That means we can't exactly tell who the originator was because we have multiple connections that match. And so the safe tenant attribution would mean that you're not able to use your own outbound rules. So if you find that they're not working somehow, it's almost always that the connection coming in has become ambiguous and we can't tell who it is. And so then the messages are treated as an inbound mail to the destination domain. Okay, that's it on attribution.
Thanks, Wendy. Yep. So you've done all of that sort of stuff. You've done all that connection configuration. It's now to validate the domain. Really, the whole idea of validating the domain is to make sure that you actually own your domain so that nobody can hijack your mail. You are provided with the required DNS changes, as you can see on the top right-hand corner of the screenshot there. No matter what scenario you're in, you will be required to validate your domain. Basically, you specify the domain and confirm that you actually own it. You add your users and assign your licenses. You set up the purpose of the domain and configure a DNS. I want to switch just a little bit and talk about anti-malware. And we define malware as a compilation of viruses and spyware. And so we do have multiple engines that run all the time on every single message as it comes through. There are three options that you can take when those messages come through. You can have them scanned and drop the attachment. You can simply outright delete them. You can also notify the people either that sent the message that there was an issue or the people that are receiving the message that there was an issue. We also do common attachment blocking. I think the number I heard this week was 90-some-odd extensions that you can set up that are strictly out of the box. You can add or remove from there depending on what your business needs are as appropriate. That is standard out of the box. Everybody that uses Exchange Online Protection in whatever scenario it is, you get that protection. If you're using the E5 SKU, you also have access to the advanced threat protection for safe attachments and safe links. So that gives you more protection from a zero-day perspective. And from an attachment perspective, if you haven't seen the advanced threat protection sessions, I encourage you to go there because I definitely will not do it justice in the time we have today. They do a much better job explaining it. But the safe attachments allows us to kind of catch those things right away. That information does get filtered back into the system, into EOP, so everyone does benefit from it. It's just a matter of time as to when you benefit from it. And then with Safe Links, it is protecting your users and your infrastructure at the time in which the user clicks that link. So we don't do anything beforehand. It's right when the user goes ahead and clicks the link. Just quickly looking at some screenshots of the anti-spam settings, as you can see on the left-hand side, I'll do a little bit of a demo in a minute, but the left-hand side are your standard settings. That's, again, out of the box, what you naturally get when you turn the service on. You do have the ability to do some customization, which is the screenshot on the right-hand side. So let's talk a little bit about some best practices.
So one of the things that we run into challenges with is moving from one solution into EOP. You will see a change in mail delivery behavior. Every system is slightly different. Hopefully, we're blocking things to your satisfaction, and if not, there are a bunch of different options for changing that, for tightening that down. Every product needs to be tuned. And so if you've spent 5 years on your previous solution, you've had a lot of time to really make it fit exactly the behavior that you're looking for. When you first deploy into EOP, there's standard settings that are applied, and as Jennifer said, you can tweak those. We've got excellent bulk mail filtering options. We've got phish options now. And you can actually take different spam actions based on the type of spam that the messages are. So it's very rich, and but it will be different than what you came from before. It's a great opportunity to look at that last 5 years worth of rules and figure out what you don't need. Old IPs on that block list, we've had some customers come with 15,000 IPs that they were blocking, none of which are sending mail anymore. And so one of the things that I try to recommend is to take the opportunity to let that stuff go and see if you actually need it. There might be a little increase in the spam in the beginning, but most of the time there's not, because spammers are very fast moving. And they'll sit on an IP for a very short time, they'll sit on a domain name for a very short time, and then they're gone, which is why the old rules, they just build up over time. Your transport rules also, if you've got complex transport rules on premises, we do not have easy tools for migrating those complex rules into EOP. So it's a good opportunity, again, to whittle them down. Which ones do you actually need? There are some things, because of the transport rules options that we have in EOP, you can change the logic a little bit. And instead of having a transport rule that blocks this sender to this recipient, if that sender is bad enough that it needed to be blocked for this recipient, do you really want them sending to everybody else? Right? So you can create a list of people you don't want to have mail coming in for, put them in a group, and then you've got a very tiny transport rule that's very easy to manage, just creating a contact, hiding it from the gal, dropping it in that group, and then mail from them will never come in again. So this is just an opportunity to clean things up a bit.
One of the other options that you have available is to enable directory synchronization. It's not a requirement, but we highly recommend it. It helps us as well as it helps you. It really does also help in the ease of the administration of those criteria-based routing scenarios and other rules that you have that are based on users or addresses in that sense. Essentially, what you're going to do is you're going to take a list of what's in your Active Directory and pull it up into our system, and we will synchronize the user safe lists and block lists that they put in Outlook that you may or may not know about. And so we'll synchronize that automatically to our system. And then we will only deliver mail that is on that list. So any of the dictionary attacks that may come into your organization, we handle those for you. And that actually alleviates a lot of stress within your organization. So again, not required, but certainly highly recommended in that sense.
So with directory synchronization comes the recipient resolver. And the recipient resolver can sometimes do some things that we're not quite expecting. If you have people who have more than one SMTP address, and they're receiving mail on one of their non-primary addresses, our resolver will figure out what their primary address is, and it's going to rewrite the recipient to be their primary SMTP address. And this results in sometimes our transport rules not matching where we expected them to. So if you have set up a rule or you've set up a policy that is specifically scoped to a subset of users and it's not matching, it's almost always the resolver that's causing the issue. So just take a look at what the primary address is of the user who you were expecting to match. And if it is different than the scope of the rule, then just we have to rescope the rule so that it will include the addresses that you actually need to have included. Another thing is if they have forwarding enabled on their mailboxes in the cloud, then forwarding will actually happen before the resolver even has a chance to resolve the recipient. So those messages are going to go out really right away. And if that is something that you, as the admin, want to prohibit, then we have to do that with some special connectors. The default behavior is to allow that message to deliver as per the forward on the mailbox. And in CMC and the EOP standalone, everything's resolved before we relay it onto your on-premises environment, which is the same for online. So spam, phishing, and spoofing, huge problem. Constantly changing the strategies being used by these malicious actors. We have some ability to help fight that, though. If you publish an SPF record, if you have EOP on premises, the SPF record that we recommend for you inside of the Office 365 portal is not quite complete, so make sure you've got your on-premises IPs in there. There is a TechNet article that tells you exactly what to include, but the little DNS suggestion that they have in the portal is just for hosted mailboxes, so that's not all the way complete there. But we can use the SPF to make sure that the senders are who they say they are. And as the mail goes out from your organization through EOP, the SPF record can also help others understand that that mail is coming from you. The DKIM record is really important if you are getting spoofed a lot. Make sure that you've got that enabled so that people can compare that signature with what you set it to, and then they will be able to tell that it was you. If mail is getting through that is should have been determined categorized as spam and it was not categorized as spam, then you can either report it through the junk mail plugin or just take the headers and forward the message to our anti-spam team for analysis. In the future, we will have some cooler things that you can do as an admin. This is the story for now. The plugin is very helpful. Inside of Exchange Online in OWA, it's already built in. If they report junk there, then we get the information. So that's very cool. But the desktop client still has to have the plugin added, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So we're gonna see how my demo thing works again. One of the things that we get a lot of questions on is from an outbound sender perspective. I don't know, just a quick show of hands. How many people have received some form of notification that their user is not able to send mail? I should see quite a few hands. Absolutely. So then how do you know why that is? Sometimes it is perhaps because the user is compromised. So we do have the ability for you to go into the admin console, go to the protection tab, click on outbound spam, and add a policy where you can set up a notification that emails yourself, your help desk, what have you. How do I go back? There we go. Touched something. There we go. You can set up an outbound policy that will notify you or your help desk or what have you that lets them know that the user has been compromised. So once you get that notification, then what do you do? You go ahead and you remediate the issue, change the password, get rid of the malware that was there, and you feel that you are clear to go. You can then go back into the admin console, and under the Action Center, you will see a list of
users, perhaps, that may have been blocked by us because they were sending spam. And you can go in here and remove them yourself. So there's no longer a help desk call or a tech support call for us. You can take care of that. Now, having said that, you are only allowed to do it so many times a month. So if there is something that happens and you have more than
25,
I believe it's 25 users that get blocked in a month, you will have to call us so that we can work with you. Something clearly is larger going on. We need to work with you to figure out what it is that's happening as to why those users are being compromised. So support can help you out with that. There's a question at the back.
Excellent.
I work in a higher education environment, and so we have a lot of students and a lot of student mailboxes, including alumni. Is there any way that the 25 user per month limit could be raised permanently? Because in any given month, we're going to have more than 25, which necessitates a lot of calls back to the help desk. And then their response is, oh, you can do this yourself.
Yeah. So the question is, it's kind of hard for us to hear. I just want to make sure I got it. But as an EDU customer, you have many more than 25 per month who run into this problem. And can we change the threshold from 25? That is something that we are considering, especially for our larger customers. 25 is not a lot when you have tens of thousands
or
hundreds of thousands of mailboxes. At this point, it's still 25, but that is a conversation that is absolutely happening.
Great question.
I have another question.
Okay.
When syncing addresses to the cloud, are there any special cases when we have public folders on-prem that are mail-enabled?
So,
because I believe that DirSync will not sync those up. I'm not sure.
So that's correct. Right now, our directory synchronization tools do not pull the proxy addresses for mail-enabled public folders into Office 365. And so in order to get mail through for those, what we recommend at this point is to create a contact in Office 365 with the same proxy address as your public folders. That'll work until you have to move that address into Office 365 if you're migrating all the way into the cloud. Once you do that, then that contact, it won't work anymore. But we are working with the directory services team in order to get that as a supported object type. Yep.
Hi, could you touch on any features, if they're available, to flag and subsequently tag what's generally referred to as gray mail or marketing messages, legitimate spam, I guess?
Sure. So that's one of the things that we handle with our bulk mail. So what we have is a bunch of information on who bulk senders are. And those bulk senders, we have reputation for those guys. So when we identify the mail as a bulk mail, then we give it a score between 1 and 9. And 1 is a high reputation bulk mail. So you're going to see, you know, the newsletters or the ads that people generally want to see in their mailboxes, those are going to have a BCL of 1. And the ones that, you know, everybody's tried to unsubscribe and they can never get off the list, those are BCL 9. Inside of the spam settings, and we'll show this in the demo, you can toggle that to change your tolerances for your organization. The default is 7. But I've got tons of customers running at 6. I'm perfectly happy. And you had a question too.
The question is around the bulk mail.
Okay.
Because financial institutions are claiming that then you have a situation where the same mail address is considered as spam broadcast coming from the organization. So my concern is how do we handle this?
Is the question that you are a financial services organization whose mail has been...
Okay. We have deployed for financial organization.
Uh-huh.
And most times they send a lot of documents to the customers. And then the situation most times is that we just find out that the tenant is shut down and can't send any mail because it's considered that they're sending a spam broadcast for that tenant. So we don't know how to...
Okay, so the scenario is they are working with a lot of financial customers who are sending mail outbound through the service that is being categorized as bulk, and they're getting blocked because they're sending spam outbound through the service. Honestly, Office 365 is an email infrastructure designed for humans. We do not handle bulk mail very well. We recommend that you use a third party for relaying bulk mail. There are some excellent providers out there who really monitor the reputations. They get those low BCL scores because they're very careful about the type of messages that they'll put through. Our system is just not really designed very well for transactional email, for application email. It's really designed around humans.
I have a question on directory synchronization. Mm-hmm. So the tools like Mississippi and DirSync, are they interchangeable, are they same? I know Mississippi is an old tool. Is it replaced by directory sync?
Okay, so the question is about the directory synchronization tool. So Mississippi is actually a tool that is used for directory synchronization inside of the legacy dedicated environments. So it doesn't actually speak to Office 365. Office 365's supported directory sync tool right now is called AD Connect. And so Mississippi goes from the dedicated environment to the on-premises AD, but you have to have AD Connect for getting from on-premises into Office 365.
We need to skip over this slide because we did that already. So actually, I do have a little bit of a demo for the Security and Compliance Center. So you were asking some of the questions here. Let's see if I can go through this whole thing without changing the slide again. So when you go into the Security and Compliance Center, hopefully you've joined at least one session that talked about the Security and Compliance Center. In here is where you would go in and go down to the security policies and the anti-spam settings. This is where you would have your standard settings where you've got your spam action defaults, your default bulk thresholds, things of that nature, your allow lists, block lists. If you go over to the custom area, you can turn that on and create your own custom policies. When you go to create your custom policy, of course, you want to name it and give it a description as appropriate. Then you can go through the different settings. The first one is your spam and bulk actions. So you can see we've got settings for spam, high confidence spam, phishing email, bulk email. They all have the ability to have a certain action taken on them. You can send them to the quarantine, leave them going to the junk mail folder, add an X header, whatever it is that suits you the best. As you can see, on the bulk mail perspective, you can set that default. So that if you're not satisfied with the default of 7, you can adjust it per your organization, whichever makes the most sense. And then the additional settings at the end help you configure if you do have that X header or prepending the subject line, you can do those adjustments. The next one is your allow lists and block lists, that where you can go in and add your list of IP addresses or list of domains. We certainly do recommend IPs versus domains because domains can be spoofed. There is the international spam option as well. So if you're seeing spam coming from a particular language or a particular region that you don't normally talk to and don't plan on talking to, you want to make sure that that mail doesn't come through, you can adjust that there as well. If those settings aren't quite enough, we do have some additional spam properties that you can use where you can go in and increase a particular spam score. You can simply just outright mark it as spam and certainly also test those options. You can then also add criteria to it as well, very similar to a transport rule where you can identify if the recipient domain or the recipient is a member of someone specific. You can add exceptions to it. Again, scoping those rules to whatever fits your organization the best. Go ahead and save it, and it will replicate out as appropriate. This is also where you would go in and certainly be able to identify your anti-malware policy. So again, as I said earlier, we have those defaults, those automatic engines that we go through, but you can delete the entire message, delete the attachments and just use an alert, or certainly delete all the attachments and use a custom alert if you don't like the one we have. This is also where you'll find your common attachments. And as I'm going to scroll pretty quick through these, but you can see there's a whole bunch of different extension types there. You can add or remove as you see appropriate for your organization. Oh, there's the list. It comes up. It's a little bit easier to see in that sense.
So we have a whole bunch to choose from if you like any of these. Again, at the end there, that's where you would find your notifications. You can customize those notifications if you don't like our templated ones. Again, you can send them internally to your senders or to the people that are external to your organization that are sending the malware. I seem to be talking a little bit ahead of my video. From there, you'll also see there is the DKIM capabilities. It will give you the information that you need in order to set that up. If you've got ATP enabled, this is where you'll go in and configure your safe attachment policy so that you can take a look and make sure that you've got that set up properly. There's the ability to replace the attachments. You can apply it with conditions, things of that nature.
It really is that easy. It is less than a minute to set it up. It's very, having it integrated in with the mail flow, it's very easy.
This one here is your safe links. You can decide to turn it on, turn it off. You can track who's clicking through so that if an event does occur within your organization and it was based on a URL, you can go in and see who it was, go and have a conversation with them, perhaps provide them with some additional training as needed. And again, you can scope those rules. Again, just very similar to those transport rules. All right. I believe there was, I think I saw someone
saw
with a question.
Hands.
Couple of hands.
No?
We're good?
Okay.
Oh, there is a Go hand
ahead.
Here. Go ahead. Go ahead. I was going to say, can you make your way to the microphone? That would be awesome. Well, they're watching at the back, so hopefully.
There, it's on.
Okay.
Hello?
Oh. It's regarding, you mentioned the mail-enabled public folders.
Yes.
And regards to the directory based its blocking, when you have the mail-enabled public folders, it's stored in the Exchange Online directory. And the proxy addresses are stored in the MSOL directory. And the sync is not applying this. So if you have directory based its blocking, you're actually not enabled to have these mails from the mail-enabled public folders because they're blocked. So you have to revert your domain to internal relay.
Okay, so I want to interrupt right there.
Okay.
So for everybody who had a hard time hearing, public folders, and in this case, they're Exchange Online public folders, mail-enabled public folders in Exchange Online. He's absolutely correct. Those don't replicate into Azure AD right now. And because of that, then they are not able to be used in the directory-based edge blocking. The recommendation, though, that you change that domain to internal relay, that is not the right recommendation for a hosted domain. We do have the ability, though, to escalate and have directory-based edge blocking turned off on the back end so that your domain will stay authoritative, but we still don't do the directory-based edge blocking. So you just have to open up a support incident and just tell them what your scenario is. If anybody tells you as a hosted domain to change your domain type to internal relay, tell them Wendy said no, and that you want to escalate to the spam on call.
Yes, I did that, and the case was escalated. I get that response.
Yeah. That is not the correct response, because we have the ability to disable just the directory-based edge blocking inside of your connection filter policy on the back end. So stick to your guns. It doesn't make any sense to turn a hosted domain into an internal relay domain. We have the ability to work around this, and if the support people are not giving you the right answer, please loop me in. I know that's a dangerous thing to say in front of all these people and everybody who's going to listen, but please loop me in, because you do not need to do that. That's not the right action. We have the ability to turn it off as a setting on the back end so that we don't do the perimeter blocking. That being said, I am working with the Exchange Online Directory guys to get that information into the Azure Active Directory for Officer 65. And so hopefully in the next little while, although I've been saying that for a long time, you won't have to worry about it anymore. But for now, internal relay is absolutely not the right answer.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
I have a question.
Okay.
Question at the back.
So yes. So we have a pretty large company, and we employ external firms to send mail on our behalf of the CIO, whatever, CEO, that come from our domain externally. So a couple of questions related to that. One is there a way to bypass the spoofing so that those can come in from my domain from the internet?
Oh, spoofing.
So I apologize. I really had a hard time hearing. I heard that you have a SendMail system that is trying to relay into Office 365?
Right. So we have a vendor that sends broadcast mails to our employees.
Uh-huh.
And they use our domain as a firm address. Right? And so is there a way to bypass the spoofing so that those will come in?
So you have a vendor who uses your domain to send mail. Are they sending it to your domain?
Yes.
Okay, so what I would recommend is for the duration of that campaign where you know that vendor is going to be sending mail as you, go ahead and safe-list them.
Okay.
Safe-list their connecting IP. And then if you're concerned about them sending other domain mail that's going to be safe-listed, then you can also add a transport rule to only preserve the SCL-1, which you get with the IP safe list, for the mail coming from your own domain and send everything else through spam filtering.
Okay, so another question about that is, do you do any kind of rate limiting? Because I want this mail to come through.
Any kind of what, I'm sorry?
Rate limiting?
Rate limiting. Well, we do rate limiting. We call it throttling.
Right, so can I override that so I can get 100,000 messages in 10 minutes?
Depends. Follow up with me after, and let's see if we can come up with a solution for you. 100,000 in 10 minutes may not be something we can accommodate.
Well, that's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but within a half an hour for sure.
That kind of exceeds the thresholds that we allow if they're connecting from one server to one server. So, but there may be other strategies that we can use for getting that mail through.
Okay, and I have one other quick question, and that is, if I have multiple tenants and I want to configure Exchange Online Protection, so I have a Europe instantiation, is there one Exchange Online Protection for all of the tenants worldwide, or do I have to configure one for each region?
If they're separate tenants, you do have to configure them each individually, but what you can do is you can use PowerShell to set one up and export everything and then import it into the other tenant.
Okay, and my last question is, you giving out those little things still?
I'm sorry?
Are you giving out the little books still? I didn't see any.
Come see us
You'll have
after.
To come see us after.
Come see us after.
And your question?
So with ATP, we've heard complaints, higher education like a lot of people here, but we heard of complaints where the attachments have been delaying mail for up to 10 minutes for scanning. Is that expected? Is that normal? Is there any planned improvements for the scanning engine? Can you talk a little bit about
sure.
that?
Yeah. So when a message attachment has to go through ATP, what we do is we deploy a hypervisor, several hypervisors, and then we take that attachment and we actually open it inside of those environments. That does take some time. Your average delay is going to be between 4 and 10 minutes. So if you're hearing complaints of 10 minutes, you're pretty well within the normal realm of things happening. Depending on the complexity and the number of attachments, the larger the number of attachments, the longer it's going to take, because each one of those attachments has to be detonated. And so that'll take a little bit more time. We do have a 30-minute timeout, though. So if it exceeds 30 minutes, then inside of your ATP policy, you can determine whether you want to treat that as malware or you want to just let it through. But most, I would say the average we're at right now is about 4 or 5 minutes. Some people are getting them in as quick as 2. But 10 minutes is a little on the long side, but it's not outside the realm of expectations. There is a feature coming called dynamic delivery. And what dynamic delivery will allow is it'll allow the message to deliver through with a replacement for the attachment that says this attachment is being processed. And then once the scanning on that attachment is completed, we'll go back to that mailbox and we will attach the verdict. So whether it's, if it's a good file, then we'll put the file back on. And if it's been determined to be malicious, we'll put the malicious file statement on there and then flip it back to unread. And then in that way, they can get the message. They know it's being processed. I'm not entirely sure yet whether it's better to know that it's being processed and you have to wait for it, or it's just not there yet. So we'll see. But that'll be up to you as the admin. If you want to enable that dynamic delivery feature, you can put it on a subset of people if that's, you know, if it would be better for them, or you can have it off for everybody. That works for hosted mailboxes only. Okay, so he said that there's another vendor who can give you a preview of the document. We do not do that. We put in an attachment that says this is being scanned, mm-hmm. and then we substitute the, yeah, thanks.
Good feedback. There's a question at the back.
Yep, this is for the DIRSync. You have EOP. Probably you could clarify a little bit more. Do we have to do a DIRSync separate for EOP, or you can utilize the Azure AD that we have already federated with?
So the question is, do you have to do a separate DIRSync for EOP?
Mm-hmm.
Who was the DIRSync for originally?
We have a Azure AD Connect, and we have a ADFS federated system.
Oh, as long as your users are all in Azure AD, then EOP consumes that information. So if you've synced your users because you have SharePoint or you have Exchange Online, you don't have to do anything special for EOP.
Right. In that case, can you guys do chained LDAP? Can we have multiple LDAP sources for lookups? Let's say I have a domino LDAP. Can we have multiple LDAPs have a chained lookup or something?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
So There is a technique called chained LDAP. You can actually have multiple dominoes, multiple LDAP sources. Do the query. If it is not available on the first LDAP, it will go to the next LDAP, and so on.
So I don't have any information on the multiple LDAP queries. I don't know.
I don't have any.
Follow up with me after, and we'll see if we can get you an answer for that question. I don't have the answer.
No problem. How do you guys do image fingerprinting for inappropriate images that just doesn't have any hyperlinks or anything? It's just an image that comes from internet. What do you guys do with image fingerprinting?
For what do we do for image spam filtering? So the image itself is evaluated against known fingerprints of images that have been reported or identified as spam. And we also take into account all of the other information about the message. So where did it come from? Who's the sender? How is it formatted? How is it built? And so it's just we have that all integrated into the content filtering part of our spam filtering.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
All right. Oh, did you want to come up to the mic for the question?
So the question is there any form of provision for a kind of self-service portal for users that they can go themselves? I mean, if I have a spam or if I feel that this is a false positive or false negative, I as a user myself can work on it. Is there any form of provision for that?
So we do. If you use the quarantine for your spam action, then the messages will go into the spam quarantine, and from there, the end users can report it as a false positive. Also, if you let them receive the spam notification, there are two links on that spam notification. One of them will release it to their inbox, which just sends it to them, and then the other one is to report as spam, report as junk, and that will actually send a copy to our anti-spam team for evaluation at the same time that it releases it back to them.
what I'm asking is likened to, McAfee, because then I know you can have, like, I can log on to a portal, like a self-service portal on my own, and say, okay, maybe I'm expecting a mail from a client and I didn't get the mail. I can log on to my own console and release that mail. So most times, that's some of the feedback we get from. It's not necessarily even calling the administrator or even calling, you don't want to get any updates there. They just want to go there themselves and then see that. Yeah.
So the end users do have access to their quarantine. So they would just log on to Office 365 to the quarantine URL, and then they would be dropped in. They'll just authenticate as their user, and then they will be able to access only their information inside of that quarantine.
There is the ability, if you're using the junk mail folder, so if you have the mail going to the junk mail folder instead of the quarantine, if you're using Outlook Web Access, you can actually right-click on those messages. If it's in the inbox, report it as a false negative, that we should have identified it as spam. Or if it is in the junk mail folder itself, again, you can right-click on it. The user can right-click on it and report it as the fact that it was not junk. So the user, in that case, also has the ability through the Outlook Web Access. That is not available for on-premises, though. You would need only for mail that made it through that we should have identified, but we didn't. There's the junk mail reporting tool that is an add-in that you can download for the on-premises Outlook to be able to then report it at that point. And then it is all user-based. I believe we still have the capability to also notify the admin, so you can set it up to send you a copy of the message to see what it is that your users are reporting as well.
Another question?
Is there a difference in the advanced threat protection functionality between hosted and on-premise?
There is no difference in the advanced threat protection between on-premises and hosted mailboxes. The ATP processes are exactly the same, with the difference of the dynamic delivery. The dynamic delivery does require a hosted mailbox, but if it's an on-premises mailbox, then we'll just default back to the original delayed delivery behavior. The reason for that is that we don't actually have permission to reach down into your on-premises servers and manipulate the mail once it's been delivered, but we can do that within the service, and so that's why that one is different.
So the part with the leak protection
that's
is
exactly
not,
the same. Exactly
it's the same.
Yep. It is the same.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we do have a couple of troubleshooting things, and we've got about 12 minutes left, so let's go ahead and take a look at that. So the first question, Wendy, why doesn't my anti-spam rule work?
Well, transport rules evaluate things a little differently than we do. So again, it's that recipient resolver is most of the time the reason why the transport rule is not, the anti-spam rule is not working. You can use transport rules to set spam scores. If you set like SCL 5 or 6 on your message, then we'll treat that message as spam. If it comes in as with a, if you set the SCL minus 1, then the spam engine will ignore the message and it'll just deliver through. If you have IPs that are in your safe list, then they're getting that SCL 1. And unless you have another transport rule that changes the SCL 1, then those messages are not going to go through spam filtering.
Ah, interesting. So another scenario, Wendy, I had my message. What happened to it? It was there, and now it's gone.
Zap! It's been moved to the junk mail folder. So we have this feature called zero-hour auto-purge, and it is available for anybody who has a hosted mailbox. You do not need ATP for this to work. Everybody gets it. And what this feature does is if the way that spam and malware campaigns work is that they'll have a little tail as they're ramping up, and then they hit a threshold where we're able to identify them as a malicious attack. And then the service will start blocking them. But what about those people who were in the early tail, right? Those guys got the mail in their inbox, and it's just sitting there for them. Well, what Zap does is it'll actually go back and it'll figure out what messages we decided were spam after the fact. And it will take those messages and it'll look for them. And if it finds those messages in the inbox still and mark as unread, then it'll move the junk mail to the junk mail folder, and if it is has been determined to be a malicious attachment, then we'll strip that attachment off, and it stays in the inbox, but the malicious payload is gone then. And in that way, we're able to go back in time and try to protect those guys who were on the early tail of the campaign.
So with what range? Is that customizable, how far back I can go?
It is not customizable. It will go back a couple days, but generally it's within a couple hours.
Okay.
If you want anything a lot longer than that, you'll want to use the PowerShell command for search and purge.
The other thing you can do is if you don't want Zap to go in, you can turn it off with PowerShell.
When?
It's available now. It's in the service right now. It's live in there.
So follow-up question, is it customizable? We're not using it yet, so that's why I have questions. Is it customizable in that I can say, don't move it to junk mail folder, move it elsewhere, or delete it? Or
it is not, at this point, customizable. Except for the fact that you can set up a policy so that if you want Zap to not work on some people, you can turn it off for some people, right? You can set a specific policy for that group of people who you don't want the behavior for. But I think it's one of the coolest things we do, and I would not recommend turning it off.
And again, it is for hosted mailboxes and not on-premises for the same reason that Wendy mentioned earlier. We don't have access to the on-premises environment, but hosted, we can certainly go in and do that. I think it's really cool, too. Awesome. Let's go ahead and open it up for questions.
Yep.
Are there any other questions that you might have? Please do come to the mic, though, so that we can help you out.
We should get on this survey slide.
Hi. So we have, we use a third-party spam firewall, and we've been kind of hesitant to switch over to EOP. And one of our favorite things that we love is a message log, which gives us the capability to actually pull up a message, grab the headers very quickly. I can sort by IP if I need to see rate things that are being rate controlled. Is there any kind of thing like that that's comparable in EOP?
So we do have message tracking, so you can get all that information for a specific message. If you go into PowerShell, you can do an export where then you can sort outside with the export. So it'll export the data to a CSV where that's all broken out, connecting IP, sending domain, message ID, whether there was an attachment, all of that information is in the message tracking.
So is there anything quickly identifiable, like through the reporting or anything, where you can go and pull up that stuff very quickly to look at it without having to do all that, or?
No, not at this point.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
We've been using EOP for a couple years now, but we've been seeing people having more success spoofing our executives. Is there anything I can do to improve EOP to stop this?
So one of the things is the DKIM, right? If they're doing an honest spoof, you should look at using DKIM to help lock that down. The other thing is there is some spoof protection. We've been investing pretty heavily into spoof this last year. So take a look at that. There's a spoof report that'll be coming out soon that'll show you who is spoofing and where they're coming from. If you know, when they get through, let us know so that we can help you. The information you give us on the spoof tactics helps us to make everything stronger. Thanks.
Hi.
Hi.
Are there some detailed information about ATP? Because we are using same product from Checkpoint, Advanced Threat Protection, and we would like to compare the features that are in the cloud and we have in on-premise environment.
So to do a comparison between ATP and another product, I'd have to have you talk to the marketing guys. They have some pre-built comparisons. I don't know whether they have that particular vendor, but ATP is pretty straightforward. And so if you go through, we had a couple ATP sessions this week. If you didn't have a chance to take a look at those, go listen to them. It really does take just a little bit to understand what it does, and it's very good. I mean, our zero-day protection is very, very good.
So are there any plans to create reporting dashboards around, like gathered around like compliance reporting? I saw a lot of really good stuff on that OMS security tool.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we're looking for, right? We're looking for dashboards. Yeah. You're looking for things you can report to execs on what we're doing to secure the environment.
The Security and Compliance Center is the new place where we're building all of those new reports. You should see new reports coming in for everything across both security and compliance features in the next few months.
Nice. Danny Popper and, or Daniel Popper is how you'll find him, and Bin Yan did a session yesterday afternoon. I think it was yesterday. All the days are running together. Pretty sure it was yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock that talks about the data insights with the auditing. So it will give you a lot of the reports, and they're looking at making it so that they're widgets, and you can pin and create your own dashboards once you've identified what the reports are. So check out that session.
Yep.
You're welcome.
Is it better to use to direct suspected spam to junk mail or to a quarantine, which has better, we're finding that even some messages with a relatively high spam score go to the inbox rather than junk mail folder. So I'm thinking maybe it's better to use a quarantine, but I'm just checking that.
Age-old debate. I think we could probably have a whole session on that alone.
Well, so there's a couple of things. When you, if you have on-premises mailboxes,
No,
online mailboxes. Yeah, so you can lower the STL threshold for your tenant if you want to make it so that the more mail is going to the junk folder. But the spam action, the biggest complaint I hear from people who have their hosted mailboxes and their junk going there is that they see so much stuff in the junk mail folder. They didn't expect to see so much. That's where I recommend splitting out the STL-9 stuff. Send that to the quarantine so people don't even see it. And then you're getting the lower level spam in the junk mail folder. But if you're seeing STL-5s or 6s in your inbox, then there's probably something not working correctly for that mailbox, because those should be going to your junk mail folder. We have found sometimes that the junk mail rules are corrupted on a mailbox. So if there's no mail going to the junk mail folder, then that will definitely explain that. But I would investigate that, and because the difference is not really which is better.
It's just where you want to see it.
Whether you want to see it or not.
We catch it still the same.
Yeah.
It's just what's visible to the users.
I guess I kind of have maybe some feedback / a question. Maybe I just don't know where it is. But echoing what somebody before had said, kind of one of the things I'm missing from previous spam filtering solutions is kind of a live message log. Because sometimes when you're troubleshooting mail, you don't know what you're looking for. You just want to go in there and see everything. You know, maybe somebody mistyped something or whatever, but I can see that it hit our domain. So not having a live message log to go in and just kind of see everything and look at trends and be able to just kind of look down through, it's kind of like the one feature to keep me from going, yes, it's absolutely a better solution.
So we do the message trace tool that's inside of the EAC. You can do seven day searches in there, and it'll return the top 1,000 results within your query. The PowerShell is to be able to get beyond that day limitation or the results limitation. But if you're just looking for trends, that you can do everything, right? You can do they don't even call it a wild card search. You just do everything, right? The last 48 hours, everything that's come through. The return result set is kind of short, though, in the UI. So that's one of the reasons why that's not totally awesome yet. But we are definitely, I appreciate that feedback, because the totally valid. Totally valid. Thank you.
So we work with thousands and thousands of customers, and we find that a lot of them are getting sent into the quarantine. Their spam confidence level is really high for whatever reason.
Uh-huh.
And so we have to whitelist their domain, and we're getting to a point where we have 5 or 6 different whitelist blocks, because there's a limitation on how many you can put in each rule.
Yep.
But I guess the bigger concern is why are so many of these small companies
In order to answer that, we'd have to look into the data, right? So it depends. Part of it could be they haven't had enough time to build up a reputation, but that shouldn't result in spam, right? We don't normally call somebody with no reputation a spammer. It's probably the construction of the message. Especially if they're using a tool, right, and it's not human-to-human mail. Like I said, our system is kind of designed for human-to-human mail, and so if it's application mail, then it's going to be more likely to be identified as spam. But we would have to look at the messages to find out why they're being tagged as spam.
So we've got 38 seconds left. Thank you all very, very much for joining us this morning and hanging out for the rest of the conference. It was really nice to see you all. If you do have any additional questions, just come up and see us. Those that asked us questions at the microphones, if you want a USB drive, come see us as well. Thank you.
Can we customize the end user wanting notifications?